Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
But I do.
Here's John Williams.
Even on the weekend. This is John. We're in the Allstate Skyline Studio. We are 18 stories above the Chicago River, overlooking beautiful downtown Chicago. The lake looks kind of pretty today. Hope you're having a good Monday. We're here weekdays 1 to 3, Saturdays 10 a.m. until noon. And remember, this will happen again on Wednesday. The White Sox will be on, I believe, 12:10 is the first pitch. That'll preempt all of the broadcast of this show, but we'll live stream it. So if you want to hear this show on Wednesday when the White Sox are on the radio, remember to go to WGNradio.com, and you can click on and listen to us there. You will always be able to hear this show, and Rokan Show, for that matter, when the White Sox are on in their broadcast version. You know, it's not broadcasting. The White Sox will be on the radio, but it'll be the same sort of show. We'll all be doing them. Just you'll have to click online and hear it there. I hope you had a good weekend. Let's just play, speaking of the weekend, just a couple of clips from the weekend. I mean, Steve was right. In a week's time, Adam Engel from the Chicago White Sox robbed three separate homers of three separate home runs. We played the play-by-play of a couple of those calls. I know the big story, of course, is the Grand Slam last night. We'll get to that in just a second. But you got to give this Engel guy credit. That team is not good. I don't know what he's going to mean to the team down the road. But he can sure jump over a fence and catch a home run.
Swinging a high fly ball that's hit well right center field. Engel against the fence in right field. Leaps. Did he bring it back? Yeah, he did. Just another one that Engel steals from a batter that was gone for a home run. He brought it back and made the catch.
Ho-hum, says Ed Farmer. Just another day at the office for Adam Engel. Reaches it, jumps up, and makes the grab. That's how I would have done it.
It's crazy.
And he did it, and he did it, and he did it. You know what's unusual is how many opportunities he's had in a week. You go half a season without getting the opportunity to run, jump up, and grab a home run over the fence. Think of all of the things. That ball has to be hit about 411 feet in your area, right? Because if it's 420, you can't get it. If it's shorter, then it has to be hit just the right amount, and you have to be at just so many stars have to line up. Oh, and then you got to be really good, and you have to have focus. And then you got to make the play. And he is 3 for 3 in a week on those golden opportunities. So where you are looking for reasons to cheer on the White Sox, if you hung in there, you had some on Sunday, particularly since they almost came back and won that game. But the Cubs, of course, are the big comeback win story over the weekend. Here's the way Chris, is it Kook, writes about it in the Sun-Times. Few events could upstage the classic pitcher's duel waged by Cubs left-hander Cole Hamels and the Nationals ace Max Scherzer Sunday night Wrigley Field. But David Bodie did the trick, pinch hitting with the bases loaded, two outs. I mean, this is what you do when you've got a wiffle bat in your front yard. Okay, I'm for the Cubs. The Nationals are in town. Scherzer, Harper, those guys, bases loaded, two outs. Ninth inning. We're down 3-0. If I hit a homer, we win in walk-off fashion.
2-2 on David Bodie, trying to come through. And the pitch on the way. Bodie drives one in the air. Deep center field. Back goes Taylor. It's got a chance. It's a grand slam. A grand slam for David Bodie. And the Cubs have won the ball game. Can you believe it?
Hee-hee. How much fun for him. And that was pinch hit. He comes off the bench to do that. And so says the Sun-Times, that's the first Cub to hit a pinch hit, walk-off, grand slam since May 12, 1959. And Hamels was good, not that he hit it off of Cole Hamels, or for that matter, Max Scherzer, but here's Hamels' numbers. Hamels yielded one run, one hit, walked one, struck out nine, and at one point retired 18 nats in a row before being lifted and the top of the eighth after throwing 98 pitches. He's got a 1.0 ERA and 3 appearances with the Cubs since we got him from the Rangers, and that's all good. That was fun. That's why you play the game. That's why you love the game. Real quick, Griff, throw on your headphones. We'll talk about this a little later on. But just speaking of all of the fun that we had over the weekend, While some folks went to the baseball games, you went to the... Stand by. You went to the...
You talking to me, John?
No, I'm talking to Griff. Where'd you go, Griff?
The U.S. Pizza Museum in the South Loop.
The U.S. Pizza Museum in the South Loop. And Steve Bertrand went to... What was your highlight, Steve?
Man, I was all over. I went to... I had a nice little tour of CineSpace, where they make all the TV shows in Chicago. Man, I had spent a couple of hours walking
Chicago
through
Fire, stuff like that.
Sets of... Empire and Chicago Fire. Yeah, we had a great time. Went to the Friday Cub game, Ravinia last night.
Wow.
I'm exhausted.
Yeah, no kidding.
I need a work week to relax.
I know. Do a little less on Monday. The news click over the weekend asked you about the NFL season, which is underway. We said President Trump has criticized NFL players for kneeling during the national anthem. So whose side are you on? And 62% of you said you're with the players when they take a knee. 18% of you said you're with the players but wish they wouldn't, and only 1 in 5, 20%, said they're with the owners on this issue. The new news click today is this. Do Omarosa Manigo Newman's recordings, book, and charges against the president matter? That's on my Facebook page, and it's at WGNRadio.com. The news click question is, it's a daily web poll question we ask. Today we're asking about Omarosa. I know. But we're asking, does it matter? Do any of these charges and recordings carry any weight? Does it matter? The correct answer is no. I believe what Omarosa is saying. I believe everything she said, that he's a racist or that he's a liar or that he's incompetent or that he's not curious. She's saying all of those things, and I would be persuaded of all of those things, but I don't believe it coming from her.
This is one of those cases where you have to step back and look at just what a weird position or situation or time we're in right now. A discredited TV, what do they call them? Reality TV star.
Well, she was the villain.
That was her role.
Whatever. She was a reality TV star, gets a job in the White House, and then writes a tell-all book recording people in the Situation Room. It's unbelievable.
The highest-ranking African-American employed by the Trump administration
was a reality TV star.
Is the first Trump staffer to write the tell-all, and this one is not good for the president or, for that matter, Omarosa. Look, if you want to bust somebody, make sure you get the spelling, the names, and the dates right, because if what you're saying is true, you lose credibility when the smallest details are ignored. But that's not why I say I don't put much stock in what she has to say. She's been disruptive everywhere she goes. Here's the wiki on Omarosa. Born February 5th, 1974, an American reality television show participant and former political aide who's best known for her appearance as a contestant on The Apprentice and its sister program Celebrity Apprentice and All-Star Celebrity Apprentice, as well as serving as the Director of Communications for the Office of Public Liaison in the White House during the Trump administration, comma, said Steve Bertrand, can you believe it? She was born in Ohio. Omarosa's father was murdered. By the way, her brother was murdered. By the way, she came upon the gasping body of her husband, and he died shortly thereafter. She's had some truly traumatic events befall her. Her father was murdered when she was 7 years old. She graduated from Rayon School in Youngstown, Ohio. She earned a bachelor's degree in broadcast journalism in 1996 from Central State University in Ohio. She later moved to Washington, D.C. She attended Howard University. She got her master's degree there and worked toward a doctorate in communications, but she did not finish. She also received biblical studies training at Payne Theological Seminary. She is an ordained Baptist minister, Omarosa is. In the 90s, Omarosa worked in the office of Vice President Al Gore during the Clinton administration. You didn't know that. She first got into politics working for Al Gore. Gore's former office administrator, Mary Margaret Overby, has said that Omarosa was, quote, the worst hire we ever made. She was later transferred to the Commerce Department via the White House Personnel Office, and there, Cheryl Shavers, who served as the department's undersecretary for technology administration, said that at the time, Omarosa was, quote, unqualified and disruptive. I had her removed. She first came to the public attention in 2004 after becoming a participant in the first season of the reality show The Apprentice. stemming from her controversial blindsiding, alienating, dog-eat-dog, in-your-face, and acrimonious tactics, teamed with her eloquence and craftiness of gameplay on The Apprentice, particularly in the boardroom segments, she soon became the woman America loved to hate. She was named by E! As the reality TV's number one bad girl. Omarosa disagrees with the villain label. She said if that was a guy, you wouldn't be saying that. Omarosa has also claimed the show's producers manipulated the footage to make her look like the villain. Oh, really? The producers of those shows edit the video? In January of 2008, she was invited to the first season of The Apprentice sequel show, Celebrity Apprentice. She became the only former Apprentice participant to be invited back to the series. And on Celebrity Apprentice, she quickly became embroiled in a personal feud with Piers Morgan. She was eventually fired in the 10th episode after serving as the project manager of the team that, according to Trump, suffered, quote, the biggest slaughter in the history of The Apprentice. That was in the challenge to sell artwork against a team led by Morgan. She raised $49,000 for charity, but they didn't win. In June of 2010, Omarosa and Trump collaborated again to create a new dating show called The Ultimate Merger, in which 12 men competed for Omarosa's affections. In February of 2013, Omarosa returned to TV and The Apprentice, appearing on Trump's all-star celebrity appearance, Apprentice. Omarosa quickly marshaled her team to an early victory on the show, winning a task involving the creation of a photo booth at Universal Orlando. In a later episode, Lil Jon's team was brought back to the boardroom after they lost. Piers Morgan remarked, quote, my argument against you has always been that you're not a celebrity and you don't have star power, which led to a heated argument that resulted in Trump firing Omarosa. On Late Night with Jimmy Fallon, when asked by Jimmy Fallon whether or not she felt the show set her up by having Piers Morgan act as one of the judges, she said, I felt like I was competing against Piers as well as other contestants. Later, she was invited to appear on, I think it was Jimmy Kimmel's show, Jimmy Kimmel Live, but they had a lie detector machine there and she refused to go on. Omarosa appeared on the first season then of Celebrity Big Brother, a spinoff of the Big Brother series. I mean, this is her resume. She was on CBS February 7th to the 25th, 2018. She remained in the game throughout much of the time, right up to the finale on Celebrity Big Brother. This is the one, remember, where she's fired from the administration, or did she quit? She made it to the finals and placed fifth. During the Republican National Convention in July of 2016, Omarosa announced that she had been named Director of African American Outreach for Donald Trump's presidential campaign. See, that's the thing. Nobody took her seriously. She's this reality show. Nobody took Donald Trump's campaign seriously. He's the guy. But then lo and behold, he on the campaign trail says, I like Omarosa. She's popular. I'll put her on the thing. And then he becomes the president. And then he appoints her to the transition team and eventually onto his staff.
Right. I mean, it's not her fault. She's a hustler. She's been at the right place at the right time.
No. Violetta's right, Steve. You can make that sound, but Violetta's right.
It's not her fault because she's a hustler?
Well, it's not her fault. She was hired by someone, so it's the person who hired her's fault.
Well,
Is it her fault for applying? Is it her fault for being there? No. She was hired.
Okay. It's not. Does she have some responsibility for being?
Yes. After
an empty bag of wind. I mean, I'll say that. Just I don't know if that's the best description, but
I get that.
If there's no there, doesn't she hold some?
Well, I mean, so what's she supposed to do about that?
She should just
keep going for higher profile jobs, apparently, because it works.
Stand by. We're going to pick it up here in a minute. Griff said, "Take a break." This is WGN.
Omarosa, what's going on? I just saw on the news that you're thinking about leaving. What happened?
General Kelly came to me and said that you guys wanted me to leave.
No, I nobody even told me about it. Nobody.
Wow.
You know, they run a big operation, but I didn't know it. I didn't know that. Damn it. I don't love you leaving at all.
I don't love you leaving at all is a weird way to say that. I think that's Donald Trump being the good cop. I think that's what you sound like when you tell somebody else, listen, Omarosa's out, you take care of it, I'll feign ignorance, and then I'll be the good guy on the way out. That's totally what that sounds like to me.
Yeah, that wasn't a true damn it.
Well, I had to edit it a little bit, but yeah, I know. Darn. Oh, shucks, you're leaving? Oh, well, I'll be darned. How did that happen? Well, we got a really big operation here. I can't keep track of every little detail. Here's General Kelly. God bless Omarosa. She's very tech savvy. Here's her taping secretly a recording with General Kelly.
Can I ask you a couple of questions? Is the president aware of this?
Let's not go down the road. This is a non-negotiable discussion.
That does sound like General Kelly. It's non-negotiable. You're being fired. Go away. You don't work here anymore. We'll talk about it later, but I'm not going to talk to you about that. Why in that room? I don't know. But it doesn't bother me that much that he fired her there. It bothers me that she was able to make a recording there. It doesn't bother me that he fired her there. One other note from Omarosa. This is where she at least admits that if you believe what she's saying, that the White House is complicit, that she has been or was part of the problem.
It is hindsight, but I will say this to you. I was complicit with this White House deceiving this nation. They continue to deceive this nation by how mentally declined he is, how difficult it is for him to process complex information, how he is not engaged in some of the most important decisions that impacts our country. I was complicit, and for that, I regret.
That's the most honest thing you're going to hear in a while, I guess, right? I mean, she's a power climber. She'll do anything to get there. Remember, she started out working for Al Gore, and she was in Grant Park cheering on Barack Obama the night that he got elected. And then she latches on to Donald Trump because he was a shiny object, and she was riding his coattails. So now she says, you know, so I was part of the problem.
Well, and to Steve's point earlier, if she knew that, you can't just, you know, jump the ship once you're fired.
I don't know what you mean by that.
Like, all of a sudden she has a moral compass?
Yeah, right. Well, yeah.
Because not having one is no longer beneficial to
her. Right.
Okay, but I believe what she's saying, but I also just don't think you can take it from her.
This is like if you are anti-Trump, having her on your side is like if you're pro-Trump and having Roy Moore on your side.
Right.
Right?
Just don't go there. Don't use that. Do you remember
take
when...
Take the rest of the day off.
Just recently, there was a big controversy in the baseball world because A-Rod on the ESPN Sunday night broadcast, not last night, but in a previous game, when the Cubs were on, was saying, I've got the inside goods. You, Darvish, the injured Cubs pitcher, and the team don't get along. The guys in the clubhouse don't like how he's treating his rehab. They don't like his attitude. Nobody had been really reporting that. And so now, all of a sudden, A-Rod is telling Chicago about this situation. And a lot of the sports writers in town blew up on A-Rod for saying that. And their logic was this. He may be telling the truth, but we can't take it from him because he's not trustworthy. He's a known cheat and liar. So we don't want to hear it from him. It may be true, but we can't hear it from you. You see the similarity, what's going on here with Omarosa?
Well, I don't understand. How could you, Darvish, and the Cubs not be getting along? They haven't spent any time together.
Touche, Steve. Last week, Richard Russell, a ground services worker for Horizon Air at the airport at Seattle, Tacoma, Washington, was able to taxi the airplane out, actually pull it in that cart, that little car that drives the vehicles, the airplanes out. It was a plane that would normally hold 76 passengers. It was empty, but because that was his job to sort of pull the planes around into position, nobody thought anything about it. Then he climbed in, started the props, took the plane off, did a joy fly for about an hour, and eventually killed himself when it crashed on a nearby island. It was a Bombardier Q400 aircraft. And I have questions about how somebody is able to do that. Could somebody else do that? And while this guy seemed to be bent on a suicide mission, what if his intention was to kill more people? Could he not have done that? I don't know what the answer to all of these questions is. Peter Greenberg is the travel editor for CBS, and he joins us a lot when things like this happen. Not that this happens, but when we have travel questions and aviation questions. Hi, Peter. It's John. You're on WGN. How are you?
I'm good, John. You know, you bring up an interesting point about how much does insider knowledge or insider access have to do with doing something like this happened on Friday. And quite frankly, let's talk about the facts. He was a credentialed worker on the ramp. He had access to the plane legally. It was his job, among other things. When you say taxi the plane, in many cases when a plane is being pulled by a tug to a hangar or to a gate, there's also a qualified maintenance or mechanic person sitting on the left seat of the cockpit who's in radio contact with the tug puller and, in many cases, the ground control operations tower as well, to be able to have permission to cross active taxiways or active runways. So this would not be an unusual situation. What was unusual, of course, is what he did next. And that is, you know, let's be honest, there's no ignition key on a plane. There's no outside door lock on a plane. We do have cockpit door locks that are activated by crew members and mostly from the inside. But in this situation, he was able to get access because he already had it. And then, before anybody realized what was going on, he found himself on the taxiway to the active runway, hit the throttles, and off he went. This was obviously a serious breach of security.
Do you think something like this could happen tomorrow at another airport?
Well, you know, we try to learn from these instances. Let's go back to where we had individual insider cases of pre-planned suicide by pilots. We had German Wings. We had the Egypt Air Flight 990, a few others. And in each one of those cases, we had one at Silk Air out in Indonesia. In each one of those cases, the pilot waited for the co-pilot, or the co-pilot waited for the pilot to leave the cockpit to go to the lavatory, and then initiated the you know, the fatal descent. Well, where we learned from those incidents is that from now on, and this is, by the way, applicable to just about every commercial airline I know, no cockpit member can leave the cockpit unless another flight crew member, a flight attendant, a purser, or whatever, takes that person's place. So there's always two people in the cockpit. Nobody can actually have one person in there and then lock the other person out. This may be the case in this situation where we learn from this so that no one maintenance person can be in the cockpit by themselves. It's the same kind of buddy rule that has now worked well since those terrible incidents.
I'm glad to hear you say that. I'm not looking to make this any worse than it is. I don't want to get hysterical here. But when I saw what happened, I thought, okay, that guy could have flown it into a building and we'd have, you know, some sort of tragedy all over again. So,
yes, he could have. But in this case, you got to give credit to the F-15 pilots who were able to scramble very quickly and were shadowing him. And had he been, and they were actually talking to him on the radio along with a controller to steer him away from populated areas. Had he, in fact, I think, gotten anywhere near downtown Seattle, I would actually intuitively guess at this point, I don't think I'd be wrong, that they had orders to shoot him down.
It's funny because the audio, which I'm not going to play, I don't think we should be listening to the audio between him and the air traffic control tower. I don't think we should listen to 911 calls unless there's a reason for us to hear that. But the audio makes him sound kind of chipper, kind of glib. You know what I mean? It was a very strange conversation, wasn't it?
It was a strange conversation, and a conversation initiated by him in a way to say to the world, you know what, I know I'm not going to come out of this alive, so I'm just going to like be crazy for a little bit. I'm a loser, and see you later. And that's essentially what happened. Now, what is amazing to me and to many other pilots that I've interviewed is what he was able to actually accomplish in that short flight of his,
right,
in terms of those acrobatic maneuvers. You know, the only hint is that he might have been practicing on a flight simulator at home to be able to perform those maneuvers. That's to me still astounding.
Yeah, he said he plays a lot of video games. I didn't know what he was talking about. But could a person learn to fly with a flight simulator, an aircraft, and actually pull that off? Is that plausible?
Not only can they do it, let's go back to 9/11. The 9/11 hijackers practiced on Microsoft Flight Simulator 2000 in their rented apartments in Florida before they ever hijacked those planes.
But they did take flight lessons in aircraft. I don't know if this guy did. Do you know?
Actually, no. Actually, John, only one of them took flight lessons, and he didn't complete the lessons. Everybody else involved in that hijacking of those four planes was practicing on the simulators.
Really? Are you telling me that on 9/11, with the exception of one of the pilots, one of the hijackers, all of those guys were behind the controls of an airplane for the very first time?
You got it. And what they did was, I'll tell you the real story. Before 9/11, if you bought Microsoft Flight Simulator 2000, let's say from a defunct store like CompuServe, or CompUSA, I should say, they had the actual waypoints in there and the INS guidelines for all the major approaches at U.S. airports. Well, what's the major approach to the airport at Ronald Reagan? It was right over the Pentagon. What's the major approach for LaGuardia? Right up the Hudson River or right down the Hudson River, et cetera, et cetera. So all they had to do, once they incapacitated the pilots, was to get on the controls and operate the automatic pilot and direct it to go to those waypoints. And the only other thing they were operating at that point was throttle and altitude, and they could actually fly it right into the building. That's how sad that was.
So you're not so overly concerned about what happened at SeaTac. That tragedy notwithstanding, you don't think this is opening a window to further kind of things like this, huh?
There will always be an occasional rogue pilot. We've seen that example already. But in this situation, I think it's a very easy problem to solve moving forward, and that is no single person can be allowed in the cockpit at any time in the air or on the ground.
Imagine if there were, okay, I was just about to say, imagine if there were people on board, but if there were people on board, then there would have been flight crew, a pilot would have been there. The only way a guy could pull something like this off is if the plane is empty, right?
Right. I mean, and he had access to the plane, and people are not paying attention to parked planes, quite frankly. But right now, look, they're going to change the protocols. There's just no doubt about it. And the first thing they're going to do is they're going to have a two-person rule. You cannot be in any cockpit on any plane, either in the air or on the ground. At least there's another person who's similarly qualified in there with you, either operated on the ground or operated in the air.
What else are you working on, Peter? I'll let you go, but before I do, anything else you want to drop in our ears? Any other aviation news or observations you have?
Well, the one thing I would share with you is this. You know, every airline is required to perform an evacuation test every year and show that they can evacuate safely a fully loaded plane with half the exits blocked with a full load of passengers in less than 90 seconds. And what a surprise, every year they pass a test. Why? They get to pick who does the test. I think they're hiring the cast from Cirque du Soleil. So now, here's the problem. Airlines are adding more and more seats to a lot of their planes. The flight attendants are very concerned about this, as they should be. And there's been some effort to get the FAA to at least change the rules or at least perform the tests again. And so far, the FAA hasn't done that. I think they should.
Every commercial aircraft has to be able to be evacuated with half the exits locked or closed in 90 seconds?
Or less. And by the way, that has to take into account carry-on bags, you know, purses, I mean, extra luggage, half the lights not working, you know, simulated as much as possible as a real case scenario. And they all pass the test. And I'm sorry, this is not a question of acrobatic skill. This is a question of real-world scenario. And I encourage anybody listening to this show to lobby their elected representatives to press the FAA to redo those tests, because the flight attendants themselves are coming to me very, very concerned that they will not be able to do that in a real-world situation.
Well, I think you got that right. Peter Greenberg, as always, fascinating. Thank you for your time, my friend.
You got it, John.
Peter is the travel editor at CBS, and there is that story about Richard Russell. And I don't know if you agree with me on that, you guys, but I think, like, when you hear 911 calls, and sometimes it's the last voice or sound you hear from somebody before they're killed or they kill themselves, or when there's some tragedy taking place and you can hear the commotion in the background and it's the 911 call, I don't think we should have access to that. If our listening to that helps solve the crime, or if you can convince me that that will keep further incidents like this from happening, fine. But what you heard on the unending broadcast of this guy's voice is the sound of somebody committing suicide. And it, however fascinating it is, the way it happened, I don't think that's our place to stick our nose in. And I feel that way about 911 calls. And if somebody makes a 911 call soon and all of a sudden it's a news story, they'll play the audio on TV. We'll probably play it on this radio station.
I think be careful. We don't play a lot of 911 tape, or try not to.
Fair enough. But I won't hit play unless I feel like that helps solve the crime or it's going to keep the next person from doing that. And you sure don't have that in this case.
This was public radio commentary, right? It was public airwaves, I think. Is that?
Well,
right, you can monitor that, or
yeah, I guess so.
I'm not positive, but I think that's the case.
Yeah. Well, I'm not saying that it's a proprietary issue. I'm just saying what's good taste.
Right. Right. I understand.
It's common sense. And the family said they had no idea this was coming. And this must be somebody who, however, you know, amiable he seemed in that broadcast, in that conversation, must have been deeply depressed or distraught.
Do you think there's any value in understanding what the person sounded like to help you judge in the future?
Well, I do think it's evidence. Okay, here's a takeaway, that somebody can be you know, that cheerful and yet be deeply disturbed. So,
yeah. I mean,
so,
I'm not,
so be advised.
I'm not arguing with you because I agree with you. I think when we play 911 tapes at all, it does just show people in deep distress and sorrow and at the worst moment of their lives. I think that's terrible. But I'm trying to figure out if there's some legitimate reason to do it.
When there is, then you can play it and I won't criticize you, or I'll play it and I hope you don't criticize me.
You can criticize me.
I think too often that's not why it gets played. It gets played because it's just dramatic.
I remember the I can't think of the guy's name now. The guy who was a little rascal, was charged with killing his wife. No, it was William Shatner. William Shatner found his wife's body in a pool.
Yeah.
And they released the 911 tape of that. And yeah. I thought it was a terrible, invasion of his privacy. There's a moment he finds his wife dead,
right,
and we're all listening to
You've got to make that call. And I know it's a matter of public record, you're calling the police, but you have to make that call, and you're absolutely losing your mind. And then they say, here's the call. Doesn't further the story at all. It's 151. This is WGN. By the way, so we were just talking a little bit about 911 calls, because we were also talking about the release of the audio of that pilot on that flight in Seattle. And I wasn't offended by it. It's just really sad. But there are times when they release 911 calls that I think it is more than just an invasion of privacy. It's quite inappropriate. And then Violetta says in my ear during the commercial break, what?
That on top of that, then we also judge people's reactions to the worst time in their life. You know,
I'm so glad you said that, because that's what also bothers me. And it's a point I neglected.
They're not sad enough. They're not.
Maybe they're guilty, or maybe they're a bad parent, or maybe they were, you know, we do that to these people time and again.
And you never know how you're going to react in those situations. So
that's it, too. Right. Will I be really chill, low key, which they say some people are when they're in shock, or will I be hysterical? And we're going to judge you right then and there.
There's a classic Dave Chappelle stand-up bit about this very question.
How's
about
that?
How they play back 911 calls on the news. And
seriously,
how unfair that is. I looked it up. I can't play it.
Of course you
can. I knew I wouldn't be able to, but he contrasts what it actually sounds like. And, well, if it wasn't embarrassing, I would sound calm and collected. Now, that would sound really ridiculous. No one's going to sound good when they call 911. It wouldn't really fit the tenor of this conversation, too, which is more serious, but he does make a joke out of it.
Well, he's able to cut both sides, isn't he? He's always funny and makes a serious point. What was the story, though? Can you guys remember? I know I got to take a break here. Maybe I'll tie this up after the news, but wasn't there a story recently where the reaction of the person was very cool, calm, and collected, and we were all judging that person for that reaction? And what was that instance?
So you can't win.
And I know. And we said, oh, look at that. That's not how a person in shock acts. And other people said, oh, yes, it absolutely is. Somebody was in shock for some terrible incident. And this will all make sense after the news. We're getting to that next.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
Calm.
Here's John Williams.
It's John. We're in the Allstate Skyline Studio. Great day to be in Chicago. We're here until 3 o'clock. Then Ro and Anna come in. Listen for us on Saturdays, too. We're on Saturdays from 10 a.m. till 12 noon. We will not be there this Saturday. Somebody else is going to fill in. I need to make sure we all know that here. But this Saturday, we will be getting ready for our Thomas Jefferson show, and I'm going to give away another pair of tickets to the 1 o'clock show. We have a 10 a.m. and a 1 p.m. show at the College of DuPage. Thank you, Steve Cochran, for giving us a little airtime today. And Steve and Justin and the gang, we're just kind of marveling at what this fella pulls off when we walk TJ out onto the stage. I ask him a few questions. You get a chance to talk to him, too. And we've been doing this for almost 20 years to sell out audiences. We have some tickets for the 1 o'clock show, and we'll give those away, right, Griff, before 2 o'clock or before 3 o'clock, right? Got a pair of tickets to give away sometime in this hour. What else was I going to mention here before we moved on to the next segment? Let's see, we covered the pizza museum that Griffin went to over the weekend.
It's a pop-up.
Here's my only complaint about this. We all mentioned what we were doing over the weekend, and Griff said he went to the pizza museum, and I just wanted to say this about this. I heard that Chicago had a pizza museum, and I thought, oh my God, what a great idea. And I want to go there, and I'm sorry I didn't think about this sooner. It should be in Chicago, and think of all of the possibilities that are there. And so, as it turns out, Griff actually went to the Pizza Museum this weekend.
Yeah. I have a couple of friends who are museum professionals, and they were interested and had a, I don't know, the jump on it or something, and and invited me along.
So. Wait, you mean so they work professionally at a museum, or that they're just really into them?
No, they both work. One works at Hull House, one works at the field.
And so is the view of this pizza museum like it's a real museum?
Well, we kind of walked in, all of us not knowing, and I left thinking it really takes some
license with the word museum.
Yeah, it takes some courage for them to say this is the U.S. Pizza Museum. I had a good time there. I don't want to bash it, but it was a room.
Would you say more like a collection?
It was a collection. It was like a room and a half of pizza stuff with some information. When you hear U.S. Pizza Museum, that sounds like, okay, well.
Here's what the U.S. Pizza Museum is like. You walk in, and there's ovens cooking pizza from all of the great different pizza houses in Chicago and from across the country. There's a New Orleans style, there's a New York style, there's a Chicago style, and you're sampling them. And there's Aurelio's over here and Malnati's over there, and maybe a Home Run Inn, Great Crust Home Run Inn over there.
I think that's called a mall food court. That's not a museum.
I want to go to a mall food court with boards that describe things. And maybe an interactive, make your own pizza place. That's what they do. All museums are interactive now.
So like order a flight of pizzas.
Well, you could, because you know what I would do? Green olives and Canadian bacon. But you're not going to have that, but I'm going to make my own. And I'll do a thin crust or a deep dish. What a great idea that would be. Griffin, your thoughts, go.
That sounds good.
Not what you saw, though.
No. But also, that's not what I require. I'm not. Those are your words, not mine. That's not what I went in expecting. But I think I expected a little more. It was one man's personal collection.
Yeah,
of
I
stuff.
Mean, so
and it was cool stuff.
If you're this guy, more power to you, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
what a sweet thing. I just think what we've done is
it was free too. That's important to note.
That's huge.
Yeah,
because I don't know who's going to pay for all this pizza I just ate. Somebody's got to pay for it. So I would think the admission ticket would include that. But then the admission ticket's going to be $33. So that's a problem. So Griffin went there and he was a little underwhelmed. But I think part of the problem, too, is it's called the U.S. Pizza Museum in Chicago. So how do you not expect 40,000 square feet with 9 functional ovens?
Well, we have so much history in this city about pizza. There's such good stories about how all these different companies got started. And I don't know if you walked away with any of that information.
Well, and I don't want to say that Channel 7 and Channel 5 and all of them were not forthright with me as a viewer, but I clicked on to watch some of the TV news stories about it, and they were all these sort of positive, upbeat, cheerful things that you might imagine. But none of them said, okay, just so you know, this more feels like a pop-up room with some cardboard mats and this.
I think I saw reporting from those locations and others that did say it is a pop-up.
Oh, did the word pop-up appear?
Yeah.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
But doesn't it also just make you think, okay, God bless this guy for at least sort of, you know, starting our imagination on this. But if we can have a museum in this town to broadcasting, and we do, if we have a museum to, I don't know, all sorts of things. Chicago should have a museum dedicated to pizza. I'm very interested on that. I'm going to appoint a board of governors. Griffin, clearly very interested in this. Violetta, you're on the Board of Governors for the Chicago Pizza Museum.
Thank you. I feel so honored.
The Chicago History of Pizza Museum. I mean, we'll...
And the food court only serves pizza. Maybe a cafeteria style? Is that what you're suggesting?
I think that's what it would have to be like.
But that would be a separate section. Let's do a real museum and then just a food section.
Right, yeah, right. So then, because all museums have a gift shop and a food area off to the side, a little coffee shop. But this one will be 9 different ovens from 9 different pizzeria joints, all cooking 9 different kinds of pizza. That would be huge. All right, we have to pause. It's 2:14. I want to take a break and come back with a piece of audio from Saturday's show. A call came in on Saturday's show that I thought was so fantastic, you have to hear her again. We do a podcast here called The Mincing Rascals. We record it on Thursdays and play back part of it on our Saturday show. It's a little roundtable with Steve Bertrand, with me, with members of the Chicago Tribune staff, including Eric Zorn. And when we play back part of it on Saturday, Eric Zorn was talking a little bit about how, after all of that terrible violence 2 weekends ago on the South Side, more people on the South Side don't tell police who's actually pulling the triggers. I said, these people know. Isn't it amazing that the people who would most benefit from cooperating with the cops failed to do so? And Eric said, well, of course they don't, because they're afraid that they'll be retaliated against by other gang members. If you tell the cops, word's going to get out, and then you are in trouble. Okay, so that's where the conversation was when Eric Zorn was talking to us about it. Harriet called in then, a listener who you'll hear here. After Harriet's voice, you'll hear our newsman, Doma T. Pongo.
You guys are very well-meaning, and you're making a very logical point in terms of, you know, talking to a police officer. But I want to say this. I'm an African-American woman, solidly middle class, grew up in the suburbs. I live in the city now. I'm an educator. My son went to the finest high schools in Chicago, and I am terrified to speak to the police about a crime. If you've never been an African-American or a minority, I'm not sure that applies for everyone, but as an African-American woman, I have spoken with police, and there's been times I've tried to get help when a police officer intimidated my son and I, and it was the most horrific experience. My son was terrified. I was terrified when I attempted to make the complaint. And if that is just for a complaint, I can't imagine if these people are trying to report a murder. You guys don't understand. You really just don't understand what it's like to be a minority in Chicago.
Well, I think you're absolutely right about that. And, you know, the implication that Eric Zorn was bringing up is that these people are intimidated, not because they're worried about the treatment they're going to get from the cops, but they're worried about retaliation from members of gangs if they're known to have spoken to the police. Are you worried about that as well?
That would be definitely, because we're not talking about one person or the person who committed the crime against you. In these instances, I'm an educator in an area where there are lots of gangs. You're talking about a web of people who could come after you.
Right. You're intimidated by a gang that might retaliate if you spoke to the cops and told them about a shooting. But you're also intimidated by or not trusting of the police to treat you fairly either. So you're between a rock and a hard place. You got nowhere to go in that situation.
I don't believe it would be kept confidential. I mean, my level of trust is just that low. And may I say one other thing, just to give you perspective, Richard Roper was ahead of me, but I went to high school with him. So, I mean, I grew up in an environment where it was the police, and having interactions with police was not a normal thing. So this is not something I grew up with. It's something that's been developed over time.
It's getting worse, huh?
Yes.
I just wanted to piggyback on what Harriet said. Even before she called, she said a lot of what I feel about this conversation was really hard to articulate unless you walk a day in the shoes of an African-American in this city sometimes. And, you know, I'm a college graduate. I work at WGN Radio, for God's sakes. And even if I'm stopping a cop to ask for directions, there's this apprehension that they have. It doesn't matter if I have a suit on. It doesn't matter if I have on a hoodie. And it makes you unsafe. Now, imagine if I was living in one of these impoverished communities,
yeah,
and I'm supposed to trust the officer to help me out. I'm thinking even about the bait truck. Unemployment in the five most dangerous neighborhoods in Chicago for black men under 21 years old is something like 90%. You drop expensive things in one of these neighborhoods and accost these petty thieves. What if one of those petty thieves had information about a murder?
Said Doma T. Pongo and Harriet, a caller from our Saturday show. I don't know what happened to the audio there, but I think you got the sound and the words of it. And I just thought that was a terrific call. Thank you, Harriet, for calling. And thank you, Doma T, for speaking up. One other thing, we do a news click. It's a daily web poll question. And the question the other day over the weekend was about the NFL players that take a knee. And here were some of the comments on our Facebook page after we posted there. Jerry said, I'm on the side of freedom of expression. This should be a non-issue and not a political fight. Kathy said, it'd be interesting to see how many of the people who voted on the news click about the athletes taking a knee know what the taking of a knee represents. Natalie said, I have no problem with the protests. What did they do in the off season, though? Did these guys volunteer in the cities? Louisa said, I actually think kneeling is a sign of humility. I see it as them kneeling to honor those victims of unjust police tactics. Steve said, I want to know how it actually affects your life when they kneel or raise a fist. Almost everything is a national controversy. It gets everybody's panties in a wedge. But did it have a real effect on your daily life? Absolutely nothing, I'll bet. Dave said, get a haircut, you overpaid, uneducated, stupid, blah, blah, blahs. David said, interesting. If one ever goes to an NFL game, take a look at the number of people at the concession stands talking in the concourse, walking to their seats. Why is it no one ever calls them out for disrespecting the anthem or the military? Jolene said, everyone should be able to do as they wish. Dan said, which countries have compulsory patriotic rituals? Bartholomew wrote, NFL-issued rules. They're free to ignore them, but not without repercussions. They are self-indulgent millionaires who really don't care about anyone else. And Sharon said, just stop having the pledge and the anthem. Football was played for decades. Without it, we don't have to have it. It's 2:25. Before we get done at 3, we're going to give away tickets to, in fact, we could do that right now, right, Griff? We've got a quick break here. We'll come back with the news. So you want to go see our Thomas Jefferson show? Oh, sure you do. You'll enjoy it. Drag somebody with you. Because that's what will happen. They'll go, really? We're going to do what? We're going to do who? And you're going to take them to this thing. And 90 minutes later, they're going to thank you for taking them to one of the most surprising things they've ever seen on a stage. A spontaneous, unrehearsed conversation with one of the founding fathers. There's Thomas Jefferson on the stage. You could ask a founding father anything you want. This is the closest you can humanly get to that experience. And about 90 seconds in, you actually begin to believe it. It's amazing how quickly this thing transports you to 1776 or 2018. You can ask him about current events or events of days gone by. So what would you ask? What would you want to tell the third president of the United States and the author of the Declaration of Independence? I'll give you a pair of tickets right now. Call or text 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. We'll take the, let's do two sets of tickets, Griff. We'll give one to a randomly selected texter, and we'll give a set of tickets to the 10th caller. 312-981-7200. Thank you, Steve. Sound of Janae Bridges. Janae is going to be at Ravinia on Sunday, August 19th. Know about this kind of music are very excited about Bridges coming to town. The mezzo-soprano, known for her, I'm quoting now Opera News, rich, dark, exciting sound, quickly becoming, it says here, one of the most sought-after talents of her generation. Again, at Ravinia, Sunday the 19th at 5 p.m. Tickets at ravinia.org for tickets and details. She is in our studio right now. Welcome to the show. Welcome to Chicago. How are you?
Hi, I'm doing well. Thank you so much for having me.
What was that we were listening to there? Do you recognize?
I do recognize that.
I know that's a stupid question.
That was Mira o Norma, a duet from Norma.
And, Mira o Norma.
Isn't that nice the way she says that?
Very nice.
Is that Italian?
Thank you. It is Italiano. Yeah.
Does it help if you learn to speak Italian? Do you speak Italian?
I speak it a bit. It definitely helps to learn all of the languages that I sing in. And the goal is to eventually be fluent in all of them. It. I'm conversational.
I guess if you walked into a restaurant and you just started to sing like that in Italian, you know, if the lyrics include, I want a glass of wine and a nice salad, then
exactly.
You could
maybe
actually...
they'll give me a free meal.
Actually, that performance that we were playing there was from Chicago.
It was.
When was that?
That was when I was a young artist at the Ryan Center at the Lyric Opera. And that was, I think it was 2014.
2014. So. Well, you are still a young singer now.
Yeah, relatively, yes.
I mean, how does this happen? Because I saw a story about you, and you were an up-and-coming basketball prodigy, if I'm not mistaken.
You are not mistaken. I played basketball for most of my life. I still do play, actually. And I was headed towards a career in basketball. And that kind of changed my senior year in high school when there was a bit of drama at school. I was in my first opera, The Chorus of Tosca, at Tacoma Opera, and we were kind of in the final championship. It wasn't the championship, but it was like the tri-district finals for a basketball tournament. And we had a rehearsal and a game on the same day, but they were different times. And my coach, you know, he agreed that I could do the rehearsal, the dress rehearsal of the opera in the afternoon, and then drive 2 hours up north with my mom. My mother drove me 2 hours up north for the game. And so when I got there, he didn't play me. And I was a captain of the team, and he benched me. And it was very dramatic. There was a write-up in the Seattle Times and everything. And that was actually the last day of my competitive basketball career. I still play for fun. But, you know, everything happens for a reason because
Are you sure you're not just reading from an episode of Glee or...
I know,
Riverdale,
it's pretty dramatic, but
like
it's real life. You can even look it up right now online.
Maybe the coach did you a favor. I mean,
I think he did.
That sounds
wrong,
definitely
but it did.
Cemented where you, if you didn't know how you felt, you did then, didn't you?
For sure. It was a hard lesson at the time, but I'm thankful for that because who knows, I might, you know, be, I don't know where I would be, really. So,
well, you would have had a basketball scholarship. Maybe you would have had a shot at the WNBA.
Yeah, perhaps.
I don't know what pays better, WNBA or one of the most sought-after operatic voices in the world. I actually don't know the answer to that question.
I actually don't either. That's so, but I still love to play, and I'm so thankful for that, you know, my background in basketball, because it's actually very similar. You
How's
know?
That?
The discipline, for one, I mean, it takes extreme discipline to be an opera singer. Practice a lot, you know, can't go out partying all night necessarily. I mean, you can, but you might not sing so well
for it the next day.
Yeah.
Well, so, but obviously, while you were a talented basketball player, you obviously mm-hmm. were a talented enough singer to be performing. That wasn't the high school production of Tosca.
No, it was Tacoma Opera.
Okay, so you've already arrived at the age of 18 or 17 or whatever you were at the time.
Yeah,
right?
I was in the chorus, and it was, you know, like
in the chorus. I see.
Yeah, I was in the chorus. So I have a musical background. I've played piano since I was 5 and sung in the church choir all my life. So.
Okay, so I have this question. Somebody who sings like that, uh-huh. when do you know that you can sing like that?
Well, I'm still trying to figure that out. But
I mean,
no,
when you were 12, I'll bet you had this vocal ability that
right.
other kids didn't have. I can mimic that. It won't sound good. Could you do that naturally as a kid? Did it just all of a sudden
come
out?
Well, the big opera sound that I have now, no. I mean, your voice develops over the years for sure. But I definitely always had... kind of a clarity to my voice. I remember when I was in the gospel choir at church, I could never quite belt the way everybody else did. And I mean, I could, but it hurt. You know, I just didn't have that naturally. But what I did have was kind of a more operatic classical sound. And we didn't really know how to articulate that back then. But it took, you know, my high school choir teacher to recognize that. And so I went to Manhattan School of Music from high school, and really it was my junior year there where I was like, okay, this is what's going to happen. I'm going to do this, you know, because I started to get a lot of recognition, and my voice was really developing quickly. So.
But when somebody has that kind of strength
mm-hmm.
and range, could you sing standards? Could you sing pop music as well and not do it in an operatic voice,
yeah.
but do it in a contemporary fashion?
Definitely.
And was that appealing to you too? Because I presume if you can do one,
mm-hmm.
you must have at least some ability at the other.
Yes. Well, it definitely was. I mean, I still love to sing jazz, and I do. But pop as well. I mean, it was very appealing, but classical, you know, being on a live stage, something just really kind of grasped me that pop and jazz don't necessarily, they don't have the same effect on me.
Well, you have the theater element
yeah.
as well, so that if
mm-hmm.
you're standing at a mic singing at a club, that's nice. But if
it
you're
is.
On stage, you're doing two things. I presume you're singing
yes.
and you're acting.
And you're acting, exactly. And you're with a live orchestra and you have a costume on, you transform into different characters, you sing in different languages. So it's a completely different ballgame. And I mean, I love singing R&B and pop and jazz. But frankly, I'm not as good at it, you know. Perhaps if I trained like I trained for opera, I would be. But yeah, I'm an opera singer who can do a bit of everything.
Yeah, no kidding. So when you do train, how does that go? Do you literally do exercises?
Yes,
I don't
we
just
have.
Mean vocal and other kinds? Or
yeah,
how does that
well,
go?
There's vocal exercise, there's mental exercise, there's physical exercise. I work out almost every day because it really is a sport. It's having been an athlete, it feels very similar because you're using your whole body as, you know, as a singer. Yeah, and we have, like, vocal exercises. I mean, I lip trill stuff
oh, really?
Like that to warm up the voice. And then I go to, like, yeah, vowels, line them up.
Vowels, line them up?
Vowels, yeah, because classical singing, and frankly, all singing, is all about, like, lining up the vowels so that they're not so far apart when you're singing. It's not like you're... you're on the same vocal tract.
Give me an example of what you're talking about.
Okay, so maybe you can hear the difference. So if I were to sing E-A-I-O-U, this is the wrong way. E-A-I-O-U. If you listen closely, it's like they're all different sounds. I mean, it seems like they're in different places in my throat. But if I were to be on the same vocal tract and they're all to be aligned, it would be like so my mouth barely moves.
I noticed that.
Yeah. And if you listen back to the other thing that I did, it's just...
like one flows
not
into
as consistent.
The other.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Exactly,
V. Well, you know what so I that's... also was thinking about when you're talking about the strength of your voice? And you do have a very clear voice. Speaking, it's an asset, I can tell. But I have, in my career, at times run into issues where... my throat, my voice starts to fade. There have been times where I was doing radio shows that were 5 and 6 hours long.
Mm-hmm.
And by
that's a long time.
it's too long. It's debilitating. And by Friday, I would start to sound like an old man. And so I go into a doctor about this. I forget what the deal was. But he just said, you know, you do not have the strength. And most people don't to do this.
Right.
And I need it. He said, you need to think about speaking more from your abdomen and not your throat.
Your diaphragm. Yeah.
Your diaphragm and not your throat. Don't use the top part of the sort of vocal chain. You need to channel down here more. And you need to talk less. And I found both of those things to be true.
Mm-hmm.
I presume you'd concur with that.
Yeah, I definitely concur with that. It's so true. I mean, I can't actually imagine having to speak for that long.
Yeah, that's what our listeners said, too. So,
yeah.
I mean, it was bad for the host and the audience. So when you're going to be at Ravinia now on Saturday, welcome back.
Sunday.
Look at my notes. Sunday, August 19th, 5 p.m.
Yes.
Go to ravinia.org for tickets for Janae Bridges, the mezzo-soprano that's in our studio. So you travel the world doing this sort of thing, right?
I do, yeah. I'm barely home. But I love it. Where was I recently? Well, I'm on a bit of a break for this week, you can say, these past couple weeks.
But so tell me where you've been of late this year.
Okay, so... my past engagement was at the Organ Bach Festival in Eugene, Oregon, and I was there for a couple of weeks world premiering a piece and singing Elijah. Before that, I was in Zurich, Switzerland. I sang La Forza del Destino, a Verdi opera. It was really wonderful to be there. And some of these engagements are really long, so I was there for 2.5 months. And before that, where was I? Oh, I sang at Ruth Bader Ginsburg's 25th reunion on the Supreme Court, which was pretty exciting.
The 25th reunion and 5K, because she's...
oh, my gosh.
She's strong.
She's in shape.
Yeah.
Yes, she is.
She gets it done.
Oh, yeah.
So what kind of life is that like?
Wow. Well, it's a busy life, you know. I think it would be difficult for a lot of people. And, you know, it is difficult at times because you get lonely. But you find things that cure that loneliness. You
know? Do European audiences appreciate opera more than American audiences?
That's a good question. It's a different appreciation because it's so much a part of their culture. Just like, you know, jazz would be a part of ours or pop or whatever. So if I have to answer that question.
Well, the answer is yes.
Yeah.
I know you're being diplomatic, but with you being in the Midwest and all.
I'm trying not to be offensive, but... yes. I mean, and when you go to the opera over there, you have every age group. It's really, it's amazing. And that's starting to be that way here in the U.S. as well.
I hope so. But my guess is, you're right, that it's been more part of the culture. And depending on where you are in Europe, maybe the language is more accessible to them. You know, maybe there's more Italian speakers in parts of Europe than maybe there are in the United States.
Mm-hmm,
So help me as a prospective Ravinia concert goer.
Yes.
What can I see? How can I best appreciate what you're going to do on stage?
Good question. Well, I think I always recommend people to do a little bit of background research.
What's the show? What's
so
the performance?
This piece that I'm doing is Jeremiah Symphony No. 1 by Bernstein, and it's the 100th centennial. It's the centennial of Bernstein. So I would do, number one, some research on Bernstein. He's such an influential composer in this. He's just so influential. So you should know who he is. Do a little bit of research on him. And then also this piece, Jeremiah, it's his first symphony. And, you know, it's such a gorgeous piece. And it's actually very, I feel like it's very accessible. You know,
it's the story of something.
Yes.
Of what?
So the prophet Jeremiah, it's the story of him, warning the Israelites, you know, that they are living in sin, basically. And so the symphony is in three movements. I only sing in the last movement where the final destruction has happened. And it's just like, come on, guys, I tried to tell you. And this is where we're at.
Really?
So, yeah, it's really powerful.
Who are you then in the show?
That's a good question. So I am Jeremiah, actually.
You are?
Yeah, I am.
I thought Jeremiah would be a male role.
Well, that's the beauty of music.
But you're the voice of Jeremiah.
I am the voice
here.
Of Jeremiah.
And so that's essentially...
And it's not an opera, so it's not like I have to play a man. It's, you know... But you imagine. So it's really powerful.
You've been to Ravinia before.
I have. When I was a young artist at the Lyric, I performed more Bernstein, actually. Yeah, it was...
I'm not going to hold you to all of the performances you've held over the years.
Songfest is what it was called, yeah.
Jenai Bridges, the mezzo-soprano, is in our studio. She's at Ravinia Sunday, August 19th. At 5 o'clock, you don't have tickets yet. Go to ravinia.org, ravinia.org for tickets and details. Did I say Janai? It's Janai, J-apostrophe-N-A-I,
correct.
Right?
Yes.
My mother's middle name is Janai, and you and I connected on that because there aren't that many
Janais
out
there. That's so rare, yeah. Oh, my gosh.
The spellings are different. You spell it J-apostrophe-N-A-I, Bridges.
Mm-hmm.
Well, welcome back to Chicago.
Thank you so much.
Success and travels.
Thank you.
Anything else we can do for you? Do you have a recording coming out or anything else like
that?
Well,
I actually am working on a few projects. In fact, I recorded this weekend in Wheaton. There's going to be a new spirituals album released by my friend, an amazing composer, Sean Opeblo. And he is a professor at Wheaton College and an incredible composer. So look out for that. I mean, it's going to be a while because we're still... working on it and recording it, getting it down. But his arrangements are so unique and eclectic.
Yeah.
So that's something that I'm working on. And I have a lot of really cool projects that I can't actually talk about yet.
Well, then you got to come back. You got to come back.
Yeah.
And visit with us again. Have a great time and performance. I wish you...
Thank
a good crowd
so
and good weather at Ravinia on Sunday. Thanks, Janae.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
How about that? It's 2:51. This is WGN.